This is the University of Cambridge Local Examinations Syndicate, International General Certificate of Secondary Education, June 2000 examination, in English as a second language. Paper 3. Listening Comprehension. Welcome to the exam. In a moment, your teacher is going to give out the question papers. When you get your paper, fill in your name, centre number and candidate number on the front page. Do not talk to anyone during the test. If you would like the tape to be louder, tell your teacher now. The tape will not be stopped while you're doing the test. The tape should now be stopped and the papers handed out. For questions 1 to 6, you will hear a series of short sentences. Answer each question on the line provided. Your answer should be as brief as possible. You will hear each item twice. Question 1. You are at the airport to meet your friend from Hong Kong. Why has his flight been delayed?
Announcing the arrival of the delayed flight, WXYZ999 from Hong Kong. We apologize to customers for the lateness of this flight, caused by problems on takeoff. Announcing the arrival of the delayed flight, WXYZ999 from Hong Kong. We apologize to customers for the lateness of this flight, caused by problems on takeoff.
Question 2. You have asked the pharmacist for some medicine for your cough. When does she suggest that you take it?
Well, there are no specific instructions, but take it before you go to bed, as it contains a mild sedative which might make you drowsy. Well, there are no specific instructions, but take it before you go to bed, as it contains a mild sedative which might make you drowsy.
Question 3. David is arranging to go swimming with his friends. When they get to Seaview Way, where exactly will they find the pool?
Let's meet at the outdoor pool at 10 o'clock. To get there, you go along the main road and take the second left, then the first right into Seaview Way. Then the pool is just on your right, behind the pool cafe. Let's meet at the outdoor pool at 10 o'clock. To get there, you go along the main road and take the second left, then the first right into Seaview Way. Then the pool is just on your right, behind the pool cafe.
Question 4. Anna rings her local college to find out about courses. What does Anna want to study?
Hello. Please, could you send me details of your study programmes?
Certainly. Tell me which course you're interested in and I'll send you our prospectus.
Engineering. Hello. Please, could you send me details of your study programmes?
Certainly. Tell me which course you're interested in and I'll send you our prospectus.
Engineering.
Question 5. Simon is telephoning his local bookshop to order a book. What is its order number?
Hello, King's Bookshop. How can I help you?
I'd like to order a book. It's called Jane Eyre.
I'll just look it up. Yes, we can get it for you. It's £5.99, and its order number is 187-653.
Thank you.
Hello, King's Bookshop. How can I help you?
I'd like to order a book. It's called Jane Eyre.
I'll just look it up. Yes, we can get it for you. It's £5.99, and its order number is 187-653.
Thank you.
Question 6. Andrea is arranging for a friend to come to visit her. When is he unable to stay?
When can you come and stay with us?
I can come from the 11th to the 18th of this month, or the 22nd to the 29th, but I can't be with you between the 19th and 21st, as my uncle is visiting me then.
When can you come and stay with us?
I can come from the 11th to the 18th of this month, or the 22nd to the 29th, but I can't be with you between the 19th and 21st, as my uncle is visiting me then.
That is the last question in part one.
Listen to the following radio interview with Peter James on Worldwide Sea Life Centres, then complete the notes. You will hear the interview twice.
And this evening we are welcoming Dr. Peter James to our programme. Peter is going to tell us about the sea life centres which are springing up in all corners of the earth. If there is a sea life centre near you, listen out for the special entrance offer at the end of the report. Peter, good evening and welcome.
Good evening, and thank you for inviting me to talk about our sea life centres. We can show you and teach you all about such sea animals as sharks, octopuses, rays, jellyfish and seahorses, to name but a few.
What fascinates you about underwater life, Peter?
Well, we know that oceans cover most of our planet, but they are still as mysterious to us as outer space. Did you know that under the waters lie mountains higher than Everest and trenches deeper than the Grand Canyon?
No, I had no idea. So how does sea life present all of this to the public?
Sea creatures can be even more beautiful and fearsome than those found on land. So, sea life centres use displays and technology to bring visitors closer than ever imagined to underwater life.
What specific attractions do the centres have on offer?
Well, among our displays, for example, is the Tropical Reef Adventure, which features a colourful assortment of remarkable corals and fish.
Okay, and what about sharks?
Ah, yes, we have a Shark Academy, a guide to their mysterious lifestyle. Did you know that sharks have been around for more than 350 million years, even before dinosaurs?
Really? And what about the octopus?
Of course. We've got a display called World of the Octopus, where you can find out all about them. Did you know...
Probably not.
The octopus has blue blood, three hearts, a beak, and communicates by changing skin colour.
Can we discover all of this without getting wet?
Oh, yes. But we do have hands-on rock pools, where the inquisitive visitors can pick up and touch many species of sea creature, all under expert guidance.
Excellent. And if we go along to a sea life centre before the end of the month, a child enters free with each paying adult. Is that so?
Absolutely. I hope to see you soon at a sea life centre.
Now you will hear the interview again.
And this evening we are welcoming Dr. Peter James to our programme. Peter is going to tell us about the sea life centres which are springing up in all corners of the earth. If there is a sea life centre near you, listen out for the special entrance offer at the end of the report. Peter, good evening and welcome.
Good evening, and thank you for inviting me to talk about our sea life centres. We can show you and teach you all about such sea animals as sharks, octopuses, rays, jellyfish and seahorses, to name but a few.
What fascinates you about underwater life, Peter?
Well, we know that oceans cover most of our planet, but they are still as mysterious to us as outer space. Did you know that under the waters lie mountains higher than Everest and trenches deeper than the Grand Canyon?
No, I had no idea. So how does sea life present all of this to the public?
Sea creatures can be even more beautiful and fearsome than those found on land. So, sea life centres use displays and technology to bring visitors closer than ever imagined to underwater life.
What specific attractions do the centres have on offer?
Well, among our displays, for example, is the Tropical Reef Adventure, which features a colourful assortment of remarkable corals and fish.
Okay, and what about sharks?
Ah, yes, we have a Shark Academy, a guide to their mysterious lifestyle. Did you know that sharks have been around for more than 350 million years, even before dinosaurs?
Really? And what about the octopus?
Of course. We've got a display called World of the Octopus, where you can find out all about them. Did you know?
Probably not.
The octopus has blue blood, three hearts, a beak, and communicates by changing skin colour.
Can we discover all of this without getting wet?
Oh, yes. But we do have hands-on rock pools, where the inquisitive visitors can pick up and touch many species of sea creature, all under expert guidance.
Excellent. And if we go along to a sea life centre before the end of the month, a child enters free with each paying adult. Is that so?
Absolutely. I hope to see you soon at a sea life centre.
Listen to this broadcast about forest fires around the world, then complete the report. You will hear the broadcast twice.
Hello, and welcome to our special report on forest fires around the world. When flames broke out in Florida's forests in May 1998, no one was prepared for the devastation that lay ahead. 2,000 blazes were reported in 66 of Florida's 67 counties. This was the worst outbreak of fires there for 65 years. Steve Parson, a United States Forest Service official and eyewitness, reports for us.
The fires were sparked off when lightning struck Florida's massive pine forests. Fueled by strong winds, record temperatures of over 37 degrees Celsius and thick undergrowth, The fires raged out of control. It was just unbelievable. We had 73 new fires start in one day. 5,000 firefighters flew in from all over the states to help battle against the flames.
That was Steve Parson reporting from Florida. One of the largest forest blazes was in Cape Canaveral. 400 firefighters tackled the fire there. We have another eyewitness report from Jim Brenner, a local firefighter.
Everything was being eaten up by flames. It was like a bomb going off in your backyard. Bulldozers piled up soil barriers, and land was burned deliberately to contain the fire. Planes and helicopters poured down thousands of liters of water, but there was no rain in sight, and the blazes just got worse.
Thank you, Jim Brenner. Well, the rain did not come until 6 weeks later. By then, 70,000 people had been evacuated and didn't know if they had a home to return to. The monetary cost of fighting the fires and repairing the damage was over $500 million, but the cost to the environment was much greater. We now have conservationist Karen Young on the line.
Yes, roughly 2,000 square kilometres of land were wiped out by fire. A lot of volunteers rescued wildlife and pets, but the animals couldn't move as fast as the flames. Masses of deer, cattle, goats and sheep were killed. Dogs and rattlesnakes were also on the casualty list.
Thank you, Karen. Worldwide, 25,549 forest fires were reported in 1998. The worst fire ravaged Indonesian rainforests for over a month. 20,000 square kilometres of forest land went up in smoke. Unusual weather, for example, changes in wind, hot temperatures and lightning can start the flames. Usually, however, people are responsible for most of the fires. Some industries illegally burn huge areas of forest to make way for farmland and building work. Loggers cut down trees and leave behind wood chips, which make excellent fuel for flames, and, of course, picnickers drop cigarettes or fuel from barbecues, which start fires.
Now you will hear the broadcast again.
Hello, and welcome to our special report on forest fires around the world. When flames broke out in Florida's forests in May 1998, no one was prepared for the devastation that lay ahead. 2,000 blazes were reported in 66 of Florida's 67 counties. This was the worst outbreak of fires there for 65 years. Steve Parson, a United States Forest Service official and eyewitness, reports for us.
The fires were sparked off when lightning struck Florida's massive pine forests. Fueled by strong winds, record temperatures of over 37 degrees Celsius and thick undergrowth, the fires raged out of control. It was just unbelievable. We had 73 new fires start in one day. 5,000 firefighters flew in from all over the states to help battle against the flames.
That was Steve Parson reporting from Florida. One of the largest forest blazes was in Cape Canaveral. 400 firefighters tackled the fire there. We have another eyewitness report from Jim Brenner, a local firefighter.
Everything was being eaten up by flames. It was like a bomb going off in your backyard. Bulldozers piled up soil barriers, and land was burned deliberately to contain the fire. Planes and helicopters poured down thousands of liters of water, but there was no rain in sight, and the blazes just got worse.
Thank you, Jim Brenner. Well, the rain did not come until 6 weeks later. By then, 70,000 people had been evacuated and didn't know if they had a home to return to. The monetary cost of fighting the fires and repairing the damage was over $500 million, but the cost to the environment was much greater. We now have conservationist Karen Young on the line.
Yes, roughly 2,000 square kilometres of land were wiped out by fire. A lot of volunteers rescued wildlife and pets, but the animals couldn't move as fast as the flames. Masses of deer, cattle, goats and sheep were killed. Dogs and rattlesnakes were also on the casualty list.
Thank you, Karen. Worldwide, 25,549 forest fires were reported in 1998. The worst fire ravaged Indonesian rainforests for over a month. 20,000 square kilometres of forest land went up in smoke. Unusual weather, for example, changes in wind, hot temperatures and lightning can start the flames. Usually, however, people are responsible for most of the fires. Some industries illegally burn huge areas of forest to make way for farmland and building work. Loggers cut down trees and leave behind wood chips, which make excellent fuel for flames, and, of course, picnickers drop cigarettes or fuel from barbecues, which start fires.
Listen to the following interview with Stefan Hochfeldt about whether or not there is life on Mars. Then, indicate whether each statement is true or false by putting a tick in the appropriate box. You will hear the interview twice.
Hello, and welcome to News Review. In 1996, a research team claimed to have found traces of life in a rock known as a meteorite, which was thought to have come from the planet Mars. Today, some people are not so convinced, and the debate about life on Mars still rages. Stefan Hochfeldt is here to tell us more. Stefan, good evening.
Good evening.
Do you think there is life on the so-called Red Planet?
Well, no one really knows. The way to find out for sure is to send a mission to Mars and to bring back rock samples for analysis.
Mm.
There is actually a mission scheduled for the future.
But surely the media reported definite proof of life in 1996, didn't they?
Ah, well, no. All that evidence depended on a potato-sized piece of Mars meteorite rock.
Mm.
It was discovered in 1984 in an ice field on Earth, in Antarctica to be exact. It wasn't actually brought back from Mars.
Well, how do you know that it came from Mars, then?
Scientific tests, of course.
Oh.
Planetary scientists tested the rock using electron microscopes.
And what did they find?
The rock contained some organic carbon from Mars and some crystals from Antarctica, just as you'd expect.
So, how long ago did this tiny meteorite land on Earth?
Oh, about 13,000 years ago. It would have drifted in space for millions of years before that.
I see. What else was discovered about the rock found in Antarctica?
It weighed 4.2 kilograms and was formed about 4.5 billion years ago on Mars.
So, how did it get into space?
It was blasted into space about 16 million years ago when an asteroid, or comet, crashed into the planet.
I suppose you even know where on Mars it came from.
Oh, yes, we do. It originated in a large hole called a crater, over 10 kilometers in diameter, near to the Martian equator.
I'm amazed at all your findings. So, why are there arguments going on between scientists about the... oh, what is the word I want? The little skeletons which are preserved in the rock.
Fossils, you mean? Well,
Some people think that the fossil-like effect in the rock which was found on Earth was a result of contamination. They think that the rock was actually formed on Mars at temperatures too high for living organisms to tolerate.
So no one is really sure?
No. Scientific opinion is divided, and we'll have to wait for results of the space mission in 2005 to find out whether there really is life on Mars.
Stefan Hochfeld, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now you will hear the interview again.
Hello, and welcome to News Review. In 1996, a research team claimed to have found traces of life in a rock known as a meteorite, which was thought to have come from the planet Mars. Today, some people are not so convinced, and the debate about life on Mars still rages. Stefan Hochfeld is here to tell us more. Stefan, good evening.
Good evening.
Do you think there is life on the so-called red planet?
Well, no one really knows. The way to find out for sure is to send a mission to Mars and to bring back rock samples for analysis.
Mm.
There is actually a mission scheduled for the future.
But surely the media reported definite proof of life in 1996, didn't they?
Ah, well, no. All that evidence depended on a potato-sized piece of Mars meteorite rock.
Mm.
It was discovered in 1984 in an ice field on Earth, in Antarctica to be exact. It wasn't actually brought back from Mars.
Well, how do you know that it came from Mars, then?
Scientific tests, of course.
Oh.
Planetary scientists tested the rock using electron microscopes.
And what did they find?
The rock contained some organic carbon from Mars and some crystals from Antarctica, just as you'd expect.
So, how long ago did this tiny meteorite land on Earth?
Oh, about 13,000 years ago. It would have drifted in space for millions of years before that.
I see. What else was discovered about the rock found in Antarctica?
It weighed 4.2 kilograms and was formed about 4.5 billion years ago on Mars.
So, how did it get into space?
It was blasted into space about 16 million years ago when an asteroid, or comet, crashed into the planet.
I suppose you even know where on Mars it came from.
Oh, yes, we do. It originated in a large hole called a crater, over 10 kilometres in diameter, near to the Martian equator.
I'm amazed at all your findings. So, why are there arguments going on between scientists about the... oh, what is the word I want? The little skeletons which are preserved in the rock.
Fossils, you mean? Well, some people think that the fossil-like effect in the rock which was found on Earth was a result of contamination. They think that the rock was actually formed on Mars at temperatures too high for living organisms to tolerate.
So no one is really sure?
No. Scientific opinion is divided, and we'll have to wait for results of the space mission in 2005 to find out whether there really is life on Mars.
Stefan Hochfeld, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Listen to this interview with Tracy Inglis about her career as a Formula One racing car designer. Indicate whether the statements are true or false by putting a tick in the appropriate box. You will hear the interview twice.
Many of us dream about designing Formula One racing cars and seeing them in action on the circuit in a Grand Prix. For young Tracy Inglis, this dream has come true. Hello, Tracy.
Hello.
Please tell us about your career to date.
Well, I left school at 16 years of age and started as a metal worker, making equipment for ships. I desperately wanted to work designing racing cars, and so I began a university course in computer-aided design. This course included programming, design, and microprocessors.
And was that the first step towards your ambition?
It certainly was. Eventually, after I finished my university course, I worked for the Benetton Formula One team and am now employed by the McLaren Formula One design team. I've been working for the McLaren team for 18 months. My input helps to design the engine management systems for the cars, and our cars are top favourites to win this season's Grand Prix Car Constructors Championship.
Do you design for other companies as well?
I help design electronic equipment for other top motorsport names.
Did you do any research on car design before working for McLaren?
Yes, I travelled around Europe while doing my university course. In fact, I spent 2 years just travelling and watching European Grand Prix races, especially in Monaco and Monza.
Did you always want to work in the motor industry?
As a little girl, I was fascinated by racing cars. To be able to work in an industry that's also a hobby is like living a dream. It's also well paid. I earn almost 4 times as much as I did in my previous job. But it's hard work.
Do you have a word of encouragement for those of us with a dream to pursue?
Yes. Set your sights firmly on your goal and work hard in pursuit of your dream.
Tracy, thank you very much for coming to talk to us.
Now you will hear the interview again.
Many of us dream about designing Formula One racing cars and seeing them in action on the circuit in a Grand Prix. For young Tracy Inglis, this dream has come true. Hello, Tracy.
Hello.
Please tell us about your career to date.
Well, I left school at 16 years of age and started as a metal worker, making equipment for ships. I desperately wanted to work designing racing cars, and so I began a university course in computer-aided design. This course included programming, design, and microprocessors.
And was that the first step towards your ambition?
It certainly was. Eventually, after I finished my university course, I worked for the Benetton Formula One team, and am now employed by the McLaren Formula One design team. I've been working for the McLaren team for 18 months. My input helps to design the engine management systems for the cars, and our cars are top favourites to win this season's Grand Prix Car Constructors Championship.
Do you design for other companies as well?
I help design electronic equipment for other top motorsport names.
Did you do any research on car design before working for McLaren?
Yes, I travelled around Europe while doing my university course. In fact, I spent 2 years just travelling and watching European Grand Prix races, especially in Monaco and Monza.
Did you always want to work in the motor industry?
As a little girl, I was fascinated by racing cars. To be able to work in an industry that's also a hobby is like living a dream. It's also well paid. I earn almost 4 times as much as I did in my previous job. But it's hard work.
Do you have a word of encouragement for those of us with a dream to pursue?
Yes. Set your sights firmly on your goal and work hard in pursuit of your dream.
Tracy, thank you very much for coming to talk to us.